Welcome to KAZI Book Review. I'm Holton Hay.
Our guest is Dinah Ramey Berry. She is the author of The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved from Womb to Grave, and The Building of a Nation. Dinah is an associate professor of history in African and African-American diaspora studies and the Oliver H. Radley Regents Fellow in History at the University of Texas at Austin. An award-winning historian, she is also a distinguished lecturer for the Organization of American Historians, and she lives here in Austin, Texas. And Dinah, welcome to KAZI Book Review.
Thank you for having me.
Dinah, what we were talking about over the air is the impact of this book, reading this book emotionally. Now, this book where you capture the value of slaves, not just from an economic perspective, but also from a personal perspective, pulling from documents where slaves talked about how they felt, about how they were valued. For me, reading this book was an incredibly emotional experience, because just being confronted once again with the inhumanity that slaves were treated with by the enslavers, it was just a reminder of how catastrophic and inhumane this practice was, particularly here in the United States.
Absolutely. One of the things that I was trying to get at with this project was to show people not only what enslaved people experienced, but how they felt and what they thought. Most of the studies that have been done on their experience with slavery never talked to or thought to put in their voices about what it meant to be treated as a commodity, what it meant to be on the auction block, how they felt when they were being fondled, touched, prodded, poked while they were being traded. And I think that I was thinking about, what did the slave think? What did they feel? And that's one of the things that I tried to come across with the stories I told. And I put as many quotes and as much of their voice throughout the book as I could.
Now, you worked on the book for 10 years. Talk a bit about how you were first inspired to begin working on this project, and what impact did having doing this kind of research. You know, if it impacted me just reading the book emotionally, it made me very angry and upset. What type of impact did it have on you emotionally?
Well, seeing that it took 10 years, I had ups and downs throughout the entire process. It was difficult to write, and I've said that, and I'm very open about it. But it's a history, and it's a part of the history that we need to know and we need to learn. So some days I just didn't feel like being social, didn't feel like being around folks, you know, especially if I had been writing for a number of hours or if I had been in the archives. A lot of times when I went on research trips, I was by myself. And even if I was in places where I had family and friends, I often wanted to just be alone, you know, with myself, my thoughts. I wanted to process the material that I was reading. And I wanted to think about how I could convey it in a way that the reader would be able to understand the depth and the gravity of this experience.
Now, you studied economics for 4 years, so your first decision in terms of your vocation was not to study history per se. How did you make that transition? You grew up in Northern California. I believe your parents were professors?
Yes, uh-huh.
And so you wanted to go the opposite way.
Absolutely.
Of them, study economics. And we did discuss the Chicago School of Economics, though you weren't a Milton Friedman fan, mm-hmm. I imagine. So you weren't a conservative economist.
No. I was an economic major at UCLA during undergrad, thinking that maybe I was going to get my MBA. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. But I was trying to avoid being a professor because I did not want to follow my parents' footsteps. But I took a class. I took two African-American history classes before I graduated. I was one semester away from getting my degree in economics. And I took a course that was an African-American history introductory course. And there was a visiting scholar who I didn't particularly care for his teaching style. And one of the things that he did was he used the N-word on a daily basis in every example. And it was sort of demoralizing, the examples that he shared. So I asked him about it, and we had what I call academic detention because he had me come see him every Wednesday. And it was in those conversations that I realized that history was about interpretation, and that every person that writes about it has their own take on it based on their childhood experiences, based on all the books that they've read and the research they've done. And then I thought, well, I can be upset with this man, or I can write my own books one day. And the second class that influenced me was a class that ended up was being taught by a woman who became my dissertation advisor, Brenda Stevenson. And she had just come to UCLA, and it was a course on slavery. And it was then that I realized I wanted to change majors. So I ended up being on the five-year plan, took an extra year to graduate, and graduated with my undergraduate degree in history and stayed for my MA in African American Studies and my PhD in U.S. history.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a live edition of KZI Book Review, a special Black History Month segment. Our guest is Dinah Ramey Berry. She is the author of The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved from Womb to Grave in the Building of a Nation. When you look at the, what, for want of a better term, sort of the life cycle, the value of a slave, what first catches my attention is there was value before birth and value after death. And one of the things that I really want you to talk about is how did enslaved women perceive their value in the market for their ability, their fecundity?
That's correct.
To their ability to produce children.
Well, it's interesting because enslaved women had mixed thoughts about that. Some women use their ability to not have children or to prevent themselves from having children as a way to resist enslavement. So they understood that their wombs, their uterus, was the what grew the system of slavery. Because the value, I mean, the body of the enslaved woman, if a woman wasn't enslaved, her children were enslaved. And so there was legislation that said slavery was defined by the status of the mother. That was in 1662 and 1663 in Maryland and Virginia. And so enslaved women knew that, and they were utilized. Some of them were raped. Some of them were forced to breed with people that was not of their choice, which I would consider that rape. And some of them had healthy children because they wanted to. But I think that they understood that this was part of their valuation. They also understood that it was up to them to continue the system. So a number of women chose to resist the institution of slavery by not having kids or trying to abort their children themselves.
Staying in that first chapter, Preconceptions, Women, and Future Increase, what impact did the abolishment of the Atlantic slave trade have on the slave trade internally? Because I would imagine with the abolishment of the Atlantic slave trade, there would be much more focus on getting slaves to produce more children.
Absolutely. And this is actually what started me on this research, is that I had found with 8 plantations in community in what county in Georgia that women were priced higher during their childbearing years. And so I was looking at the 1808, which is when the transatlantic slave trade ended, to see if the domestic slave trade really fueled the value of female slave women's bodies, because most of the scholarship had only focused on prime male slaves and they didn't care about the values of women. So what it does happen is that you do see an increase in purchasing women. You see an increase in people trying to make sure that women are giving birth. They're putting warranties on women's wombs. So when they purchase an auction, they'd say she needs to give birth within 5 years of these X number of children. And if she doesn't, I'm going to take you to court. We have court cases where people were sued because these women that they purchased expecting them to give birth didn't. And so the legal record really shows that. But what I did find is that women were not priced higher than men across the board, and that those 8 plantations were sort of an anomaly. They were outliers, and that across the board, men were priced higher, even women in their childbearing years.
How did this affect the type of language that was used to discuss them? Because there's this certain apersonal, non-personal discussion of human beings as if they were actually things.
Yes.
And just, and it's the obvious, the commodification, but this level of dehumanizing slaves and their children is, to me, is just a reminder of how astoundingly horrific this experience had to be.
Yes. From an enslaver's perspective, they would refer to them as products. And I say that one of the things I was trying to do with the book was allow readers and us to be comfortable, even though it's an uncomfortable topic, but to be comfortable knowing that enslaved people were products and people. And they knew that. They were raised to understand that they were treated externally as a commodity, but they knew internally that they were a human being. And they used their humanness to disrupt sales in as many on as many occasions as they could.
Now, you have a whole sort of terms that you use in terms of the values of slaves.
Yes.
And you have ghost values, soul values, fiscal values, monetary values. A lot of different ways you've used to describe, and basically some new and different terms. So let's talk about the one of the terms that will probably, people say, what do you mean when you say ghost values?
Okay. So ghost value is the value of the body after death. Sometimes in sleep, people were valued at the time of death, like in an autopsy. And what I found was that even beyond their deaths, their bodies were still being treated as a commodity when they were sold and trafficked as part of an illegal trade, which I call the domestic cadaver trade, where their bodies were sold to medical schools for anatomical research. So they were then put on tables and dissected so that they could study the human body.
So you did a lot of, you had to have done a lot of research to start to understand the cadaver industry and what was going on at that time. And what impact did that have on you discovering how they treated bodies after death?
You know, it's a great question because I have always been a donor, an organ donor. And I've gone back and forth through the process of writing this book on whether or not I still want my organs donated, which is horrible because I have family and friends who are living today because of organ donation. And so, but I struggled because I saw through the history the disrespect that was given to these bodies. The fact that they were not, even bodies that were buried by their families were then illegally exhumed and stolen and trafficked and put on dissection tables, and their family members never even knew it. And so that bothered me. So that's another part of the ghost value. The other area that you can see ghost values is when somebody died in the hands of somebody else, an enslaved person died, maybe they've been on loan to work for somebody, and they would be valued based on what they were at that current time, at the time of death. And then if there was a court case, if somebody went to sue them because they'd killed their enslaved person, sometimes that court case took 4, 5, 6, 7 years. And whoever won received the value of the body at death plus interest. And so I say that these ghost values are the commodification and the valuation of dead bodies well beyond their life cycle.
And one of the stories you share is the story of Nat Turner and mm-hmm. what happened often to slaves that were in rebellion. Mm-hmm. And one of the most shocking things I read was that because of how they felt about insurrection, that they literally, and this is just horrendous, mm-hmm. that the body of slaves that were in insurrections were, parts of them were used to create products. And Jesus.
Yeah, it's every, I mean, that was probably the most difficult part for me to read. And I had a difficult time trying to find a way to write it. And I didn't want to distance my reader because it's hard. It's a hard section to really get through. So their bodies were dismembered. Their skin was, they were skinned. They used the grease. They burned their bodies. They burned the skin. They used the grease for oil. They dismembered their ears. They took off their ears. They cut off their noses. They threw bodies into pig pens and let the hogs tear them up. And there was a spectacle nature of this because people stood by and watched this. And for them, those that were witnessing it, I argue, it was like retribution for them. You know, they felt like, yes, this person deserves this because they tried to uphold or upthrow the institution of slavery.
And you do write that his body, talking about Nat Turner in particular, represented all that whites fear about enslaved people. But I do want to ask you this. Mm-hmm. Did they do this to John Brown's body when he had his insurrection with Harper's Ferry? And was it the late 1850s?
Great, 1859. Great question. So in the chapter 4, I talk about John Brown, but I'm focusing on the African Americans, both free and enslaved, that were part of his insurrection. And in his raid on Harper's Ferry, Virginia. And what I show to the reader is that there's a contrast between the way John Brown's body is treated, a free black man's body, John Copeland, is treated, and Shields Green is treated. So you have who was an enslaved man. John Brown's body, once he was hung, and they were all hung on the same gallows, and there's a picture of the gallows that they were hung on in the book. They were hung on the same gallows. John Brown's body was put in a fine quality wood casket and given over to his wife and family, and they took it back to New Albany, New York for burial. But the bodies of the African Americans that were hung were given shallow graves that were then fought over because medical students were there from Virginia, dug up their bodies, and took them to the medical school. So the story of John Copeland, a free black man who was from Oberlin, Ohio, is in there. And I talk about how his family from Ohio sent a representative to come bring his body back so they could give him a proper burial. And they had to get permission from the governor of Virginia, Governor Wise. They got that permission. They sent, the governor said, send a white representative. The family could not even come to get his body. So they sent a white representative to go get the body. And when he got there, the medical students refused to give him the body. And so they never received the body back. And this is a free black man. But when he went in to look for the body, went into the dissection room, he saw the body of one of the enslaved black men laying on the table with his eyes open, which is a sign of disrespect. When a person passes, you're to close the eyes. And there was no family to claim him. So they ended up having a memorial with empty caskets in Oberlin, Ohio, and there were 3,000 people that came, and there's a monument honoring both John Copeland and Shields Green and Dangerfield Newby.
In light of the movements of today, the civil rights movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, mm-hmm. What lesson you think we can learn from reading your book in terms of the just inhumane level of disrespect that was the way that slaves were treated?
Well, one, I just want the general readership to understand the history of black bodies being treated as products and hopefully gain strength in seeing the survival, because there's no way that in 1865, 4 million people would have been freed if they didn't survive slavery. So I'm hoping that there's even though this is very difficult to read, that there is some resolve in the fact that African Americans survived. Now, it also gives us context to the videotapes that we're seeing, the television images of bodies laying in the street. You know, Ferguson, Virginia, Ferguson, Missouri, Michael Brown's body being in the street for 4 hours. You know, that reminded me of some of these stories in here. So I just hope that it provides a historical context and that we will understand that this devaluation is what I refer to it, has happened over and over again through history.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Dinah Ramey Berry. She is the author of The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved from Womb to Grave, and The Building of a Nation. Dinah is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin. One of the things I did want to make sure that we covered before we began to close out the interview was you talked about the impact enslaved women's bodies had as being a catalyst for 19th century economic development.
Mm-hmm. Because they gave birth to more slaves. They gave birth to, if they were enslaved, they gave birth to more slaves. So I'm saying that the institution of slavery, after the transatlantic supply was cut off, was maintained through the birth of slaves through women's bodies. I'm not blaming black women. I'm just saying that that's what's unique about U.S. slavery. We had chattel slavery here, which meant they were movable forms of property. And if as long as women were still giving birth, then the system of slavery would remain.
And so when you look at it just from a pure economic perspective, the contribution of slavery and the bodies of women to the economic empowerment of this whole country, the black community has never got any sort of equitable compensation for all that was given to build this country.
Exactly. And I think it's ironic because enslavers whose slaves were executed for committing crimes received compensation from state governments on the value of the body of their enslaved laborers that were hung because of a crime. I think there's some irony there.
Now, you are working on a new book.
Yes.
And you're working with Kali Nicole Gross, who was a professor at UT Austin. Now she's gone. I guess she's gone back to the East Coast.
Yes.
I believe she's from the East Coast.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about your new book that you're working on.
So Dr. Gross and I are writing a book called A Black Woman's History of the United States. And it's going to be published by Beacon Press probably in 2018, if I'm correct. And it's also written for a wide audience. Currently, there really aren't any textbooks that we can use for teaching Black women's history. And this field has proliferated in the last few years. There are a number of books out there on every time period in U.S. history. So what we're doing is trying to write a study that we're co-authoring that looks at some of the unknown figures of African-American women's history. You know, not that we're ignoring the Rosa Parks and the Harriet Tubmans, but we're trying to cover stories of lesser-known figures.
Dr. Dinah Ramey Berry, The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, The Value of the Enslaved from Womb to Grave, and The Building of a Nation. Thanks for being a guest on KZR Book Review.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.